we're back. We're radiating again.
We're radiating.
Yeah, we are
shooting photons all over the place.
We're radiating whatever analog technology, not merely on the internet. This is Ask an Atheist, 844 Skeptic, 844-753-7842. Toll free nationwide. My name is Sam. With me today is back from her very brief vacation and my somewhat longer one. Becky, how are you?
I'm doing great, Sam.
And third week in a row. What's going on, Dan?
I am pumped like a balloon animal.
Is that a good thing?
No, it's fine. Yeah.
Okay, because that sounds creepy.
He's also twisted like a balloon animal.
And squeaky like a balloon animal.
I am now terrified of balloon animals.
My work here is done.
Speaking of balloon animals, disgraced pastor Mark Driscoll has announced he will be opening a new church in Phoenix, Arizona. The former leader of Mars Hill Church in Seattle was forced to resign after it was revealed that he bullied church administrators, anonymously attacked parishioners on church message boards, plagiarized sections of his book, and used church funds to artificially boost book sales to get on the New York Times bestseller list. A video released on the new church's website features Driscoll and his wife talking about their plans in Phoenix. While the video vaguely references the issues of the past, neither it nor his bio on the website actually mentions Mars Hill or the scandals that forced Driscoll's resignation.
So I want to know whether his church will be as ephemeral as a child's balloon animal.
Well done. So, Becky, is Mark Driscoll the anti-Sam Mulvey?
The anti-Sam Mulvey? I'm not sure. You have no New York Times bestsellers.
Yeah.
You don't have a... we do have a website with you. And I don't know. What would make Mark Driscoll the anti-Sam Mulvey?
I have anonymously said things at people, although you don't know about that. I escaped Arizona to move to Washington.
Yes, there we go.
On a cloud of complaints, and he went from Seattle to Arizona on a significantly larger cloud of complaints.
I think you are indeed the anti-Mark Driscoll.
So I can't imagine this is going to work particularly well this time. I mean, you can hide it on your bio. I don't think that's going to change a whole lot.
He already had ventured into the Southwest with his Mars Hill ventures. I believe that Albuquerque, New Mexico, had a Mars Hill church, but I don't know. I mean, people are yearning for community, and Mark Driscoll really is, you know, the face of that kind of, like, hip, you know, guy. He's a pastor. He wears his jeans with his tucked-in shirts and stuff like
that. Has weird ideas about human sexuality, which I can't really talk about on the air.
Indeed.
Because it's really kind of gross.
Let's reflect on that for a while, shall we?
Ouch.
Long-time listeners will reveal it. Will
appreciate that one, perhaps. Yeah. I'm a long-time listener. I'm not certain I do. So I actually listened to this recording, and because oddly enough, it was covered in local news up here quite extensively.
Well, he made a lot of waves up here in Seattle.
Yeah, and he had a church here in Tacoma for roughly 17 minutes. He bought out an Episcopalian church, converted into a Mars Hill church, and then I think it was open for like less than a year.
You know, a thing that was interesting to me in the last place that we lived, my wife and I were like in between a Mars Hill church and a Jehovah's Witness temple. And the first people to come to the door.
So did your house get hit by a lot of spitballs?
No. But the first people to come to the door were the Mormons. We invited them in and congratulated them for beating the competition. Like, there is no way. I mean, they're literally 25 feet away, and you guys showed up first. Well done, guys.
That's
good on you.
Yeah, that's a really tight domestic espionage network Mormons have there. But he's not really opening a church yet. We're not at the opening a church thing. What he's basically doing is saying, I would like to open a church, don't know where, don't know when, give me money. That's basically what he's saying in this video.
Is this any different from his whole spiel and his whole existence prior to his supposed move to Arizona?
What do you mean?
The give me money. Don't know what we're going to do with it yet.
Well, has his song changed ever?
I don't know. I mean,
no, literally not like the whole history from before Mars Hill Church to disgraced ex Mars Hill Church guy and now guy in Phoenix. Has he ever not been asking for money in one, like, openly?
Well, the part that he used church funds to artificially boost his book sales, he was using church funds, not just church funds, but funds that specifically people
nice
had
dodge.
Donated to like a children's fund.
But you've been paying attention to the story for a long time. Have you ever known him not to be asking for money?
No.
No.
Yeah. I mean, this is on that story, it's barely a story. However, you know what? If you really want somebody with much better morals than Mark Driscoll to open up a church, send me a check. Or maybe Dan, I mean, you're pointing at it. What?
Yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah. This,
you've got a radio show to run. Let me do the I'll start some sort of for science church function.
Well, that's
I don't know
is,
where and I don't know when, but
what
send
I would
me
do
money.
Is I would start a church. I would start a church and not tell anybody what it's for.
Sure. Well, I mean, at some point you're going to have a congregation.
Right. And they don't know.
They're like, "Well,
it's a mystery church." Da da da. No. Yeah.
My apartment will lie in between the Church of Dan and the Church of Sam, and
the Church of Dave is the first one to knock on the door.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I'm not giving my money to any of you guys.
This guy is he only knows how to make a living by being kind of a gross church guy, I guess. That's the story here.
Apparently he's making some living. I'm not sure at that point.
Are you sure he's the one who's making it? I mean, that's, you know, if I went through a huge scandal, I might be unemployed for some time and living off the grace of others, if you will.
Could be. You know, it does raise an interesting point, though, that he moved specifically to Phoenix, Arizona, because the greater Phoenix metro area is a place with a high Mormon population. So maybe, Dan, they got wind of the fact that LDS folks were knocking on your door in the Seattle area, so they just figured that they would go and knock on the doors in the stomping grounds of LDS folks.
That's right. You got to take it where they live. That's...
I don't know that Mark Driscoll will be wooing any Mormons.
Are you positing some like weird secret war between Mars Hill and the Mormons?
I am in no way
obvious, you know, competition that goes on between any of your 800,000 different chains of Christianity.
I am in no way positing such things.
You heard it here first. Tabernacle versus the Mormons.
No, I don't know. I'm kind of baffled by it. I guess since Mark Driscoll really he's a one-note guy. You know, he writes his books with his wife.
Yeah,
Ghost writes his books with his wife on how to be a good pastor and good Christian and good husband, and says some very strange things that are out of line with what modern sociology and psychology would dictate.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's really going to be any way for Mark Driscoll to be reborn in anything other than
a
previous incarnation.
But does he need to be? This is a really good question, because I don't think he needs to be reborn in order to sort of get inside, to get back to where he was before. Beatles reference. Because it wasn't like there's the population of people who's like, yeah, he's a new hip creepy church guy, and it wasn't those people that made him the disgraced pastor Mark Driscoll. It was a palace revolution, and I imagine the population of people who finds the fact that he says all of these weird things, that's still a population of people that exists. That's still a population of people who may not see him as a disgraced pastor, but as
a wronged pastor,
wronged
by his congregants.
Yeah, and so maybe this is what's going to happen. I mean,
and it takes about, you know, 5 to 10 years for one's congregants to then see the emperor is wearing no clothes. So maybe he's got another 5 to 10 years of life in him.
Or you are being really charitable to humans. Yeah, that's incredible.
I think,
am I?
Yeah.
I think if he's going to turn this around, he is going to have to make some personal changes and start with the man in the mirror.
Okay, so what I'm saying is, since it was a palace revolution that kicked him out, he's probably going to go for a church that has a lot more central control, that can't kick him out, where he's making a lot more of the calls, where it really is more of a church centered around him himself and his particular brand of teachings, and rather a community church like he was trying to sell Mars Hill as?
It's a good thought. You know, when we interviewed former Mars Hill congregants a few years ago, one of the things that did come out was that struggle between something that was very autocratic and very Mark Driscoll-centered versus...
Yeah.
a collection of elders that had some kind of mutual consensus-based decision-making powers was one of those struggles that really precipitated the downfall of Mars Hill and the closure of the churches and the franchises, because you had people that were disgruntled and wanted more of a stake in the decision making, in the shared decision making.
Well, that's because they were sold something that was more, you know, they were told they were entering a community, a type of community, and they were. What they were entering in was a cult. But what I'm saying is, this is not a world that immediately hates cults. There are people out there who sometimes are looking to join something precisely like what Mars Hill was. They're not like looking at it like, oh, I want to be brainwashed, but it's a predatory thing, and there is prey out there, is what I'm saying, who would be totally subsumed by such a thing. What I'm trying to do is obliquely basically make parallels to some of our more infamous cases of you know, cult behavior in the United States, like Jim Jones and stuff like that. Like Jim Jones specifically was a member of a bunch of churches, started a bunch of churches. He was kicked out of a lot of them and basically kept looking for more and more and more central control until he basically had to move to another country and found his own town in order to get the level of control that he wanted. And then once he finally had it, he killed everybody. Like there's actually something a little bit scary in this kind of behavior here. Are we in a post Jim Jones era where that sort of thing is impossible, or are we, you know, is this actually a concern of mine, or am I just being silly?
Well, the Heaven's Gate thing wasn't really that long ago.
No.
I mean,
no.
This sort of stuff could certainly happen again. When you have a charismatic central character that wants all this sort of control and can get this sort of control.
Yeah.
In my mind, that makes them a person that is very socially dangerous.
Right.
You don't even have to look for something like Heaven's Gate that wasn't too long ago. We have things in the United States now. We have things in other countries now. We have in the United States, we have enclaves of fundamentalists from lots of different flavors of places. You have in New Jersey and New York, almost strictly Yiddish-speaking, ultra-Orthodox enclaves that are hugely controlled by very powerful rabbis. You have fundamentalist Latter-day Saints churches that, like Jim Jones, own their own town practically. Mm-hmm. So I think that you may be onto something there, Sam, where you say that there is prey
there
out
is,
there.
There is a significant difference between Jim Jeffords, who we'll be talking about later, and a lot of these folks in upstate New York that you're talking about, and a person like Mark Driscoll. And that's not charismatic in the religious sense, like a charismatic religion, but a charismatic leader who has a very egocentric, focused sort of approach to these sorts of religious things. Where the Mars Hill Church, it was sold as a community church. I remember hearing about it before the days where they got infamous. Here in Seattle, it was like, you know, it's a church young people go to when they want.
They've got rock and roll music.
Yeah, when they want a community. But then when they started getting attention, because a lot of people were going to this church, you would hear more. The only thing you would hear about, and it seemed like the only thing they would talk about, would be Mark Driscoll, what he's saying this week, what he's thinking this week, what the book is going to be about, his hair, etc.
To the point where at the franchised churches, it was Pastor Mark that was jumbotroned into all of the churches.
Yeah, we've got friends who had spoken to people in the clergy at Mars Hill Church, and their main job was mash and go on a DVD player so that they could see, you know, Pastor Mark's work. And any, you know, discussions that may go against his teachings was considered somewhat a subject to avoid. Even within the clergy. And that's the kind of behavior that scares me. It's all too common. But when you've got somebody who can really make it work, as Mark Driscoll has a record of doing, something really terrifying can result. So he may be disgraced, and I'm not saying he's Jim Jones. I'm not saying, well, what the hell I am. But what I'm saying is that it might not go that route. What this needs to avoid that is more attention, is that it's not hate or appropriation that makes this sort of thing go away. It's light. Pay attention to him. Don't let him creep off to, I don't know, some country you've never heard of. And you can avoid a lot of these problems. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. Let's go into a break. When we come back, there's a lot of In God We Trust type stuff news in the week this week, and yeah, go into that.
The Humanists of Washington is the oldest humanist organization in the state and offers a community of freethinkers who educate the public and celebrate life. Come celebrate life with us. Humanists support intellectual freedom and critical thinking and hold that human beings are autonomous centers of moral development. You can become a member of the Humanists of Washington at humanistsofwashington.org. You'll get our quarterly publication, The Secular Humanist Press. Check out meetup.com where you can be part of our monthly Seattle dinner and our Heathens Do It Better breakfast. Humanists of Washington.
If you enjoy the programming we create on Ask an Atheist, please make a contribution with us. Your sponsorship keeps our show in the air and improves the quality of our broadcasts. Don't make us beg. Please go to askanatheist.tv and contribute today.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
If you are a humanist, atheist, or freethinker from Everett, Washington to the Canadian border, Humanists of North Puget Sound welcomes you. Your freethought neighbors to the north have been promoting secular ideas for over 20 years. They're humanists, with a rational worldview informed by science, inspired by art, and motivated by compassion. Join up for monthly conversation, camaraderie, and activism. Humanists of North Puget Sound. Visit humanistsnps.org.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Dorn, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is the United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio Versus the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. And a lot of In God We Trust stuff in the news these days, it seems like. Which, as you know, and which I've never never suggested otherwise, is our nation's motto. It's kind of a dumb one, if you ask me. But now, and the interesting thing is Becky, how does the court think about In God We Trust? It's kind of convoluted.
Yeah, so we have references to God, either in municipal prayer or in our motto or in our pledge, as ceremonial deism, as a head nod to the way that our founders considered the word God. And we have a very expansive view from a lot of judges and from municipal leaders that said, well, God can mean anything to you.
Right.
And we have people insisting that this is in no way anything religious or Christian.
Right. However, and as we now know, that doesn't always end up being the case. For example, a Virginia sheriff's office announced that we'll be adding In God We Trust bumper stickers to its cars for explicitly religious reasons. The Tazewell County Sheriff, Brian Hyatt, said in a statement that the department feels strongly about the stickers and that they couldn't help the community without the guiding presence of our Lord. Hyatt also bragged that the sheriff's office holds weekly Bible studies. The Freedom From Religion Foundation wrote a letter explaining that the sheriff was in violation of the Establishment Clause by using the nation's motto in a religious way instead of the secular ceremonial way as approved by the court. So, yeah, it's... When I say that the motto has problems, this is exactly what I'm talking about, is you say, well, there's ceremonial deism and stuff like that, and do all this arm, all the hand-waving you like, but it just invites knobs like this to bring in, to say, oh, well, yeah, now, well, because of our motto, we can now have Bible study in our, police studio? Office?
Station.
Station, thank you, that's the word I'm looking for. You know, what do you think about this?
I have to say, for one, I'm absolutely shocked by the behavior of the Tazewell County Sheriff.
Ah, don't be so negative.
It sounds like they've really got their wires crossed on this one.
Totally.
I know this is a really highly charged issue, but what we have to look at here is indeed, no, we have the sheriff saying, because In God We Trust is allowed, that means that everything related to the Christian God is allowed. And that's where this problem lies. That's where that's the complaint that secularists have with police officers and sheriffs and police chiefs across the country saying, I'm going to join in on this movement because you're not going to let me interfere with my religious belief and my religious freedom. And plus, police can't do their job without the guidance of the Lord, without the guy. When you say Lord, which Lord do you think we're talking about, Sam? I mean, is there, in your experience, you've gone to all these county council meetings and you've heard all these politicians and all these folks. When they say Lord, do they mean anything other than the Christian God?
No, clearly not. I mean, in Pierce County, in Clark County, in all the places that, places in California, anywhere that this In God We Trust thing has taken hold, somebody has suggested that perhaps you mean something a little bit more religiously inclusive. And every time I've had a conversation with these folks who think this is important to put these signs up everywhere, I say, they make it, when we opt for something that's not explicitly Christian, wait, I'll let me back up for a minute. First, they start by saying, well, it's a religious message. It's a religious message everybody can get behind. I understand, yes, it is a religious message, but it doesn't really mean anything, et cetera, et cetera. And then so you start throwing curveballs out there like, oh, you mean like Lord Krishna or something like that. They go, wait, no, we are talking about our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And if you can't get behind that, blah, 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 blah. They start out by saying it's ceremonial or it's a message that everybody can get behind or it's something that shouldn't be patent. It shouldn't be obviously offensive. And then you challenge them. You ask them a question. Not even like challenging, like, oh, you guys are like this. Like, sometimes I want to know what, I honestly just want to know what they're thinking. And I ask a question is like, okay, so this could be any God? I don't really understand. Snap. Now it's about our Lord Jesus Christ. Now it's specifically a message about a specific religion. And what's weird is that sometimes it's about a specific type of Christianity as well.
I've also heard, no, this is about our Heavenly Father.
Right, exactly. So the whole, this is ignorance of our history, of the history of the United States. When you make these arguments that, oh, no, everybody can get behind this message, you are ignorant of our history. You are, you basically have forgotten why the First Amendment reads the way it does.
The First Amendment is for individuals, not for government, right?
Right.
to say the government can freely practice their religion.
Yeah, and it says that in the document. I mean, this is not an easy thing to misread.
I think everything that I kind of have to say about this one has been said. It's like, well, this is clearly it's the national motto, but they're saying it's for explicitly religious reasons.
Yeah.
You've got the sheriff coming out and saying, without the guidance of our Lord. Well, that introduces some bias to me, and bias is not a thing that you want in law enforcement or any branch of government, but specifically law enforcement, because we do have absolute ideas in biblical teachings, and absolute ideas, I think, are things that police officers should not have to adhere to. There is room for fudging the protocol. Sometimes you extend more compassion. Sometimes you realize that a situation does need to be escalated rather than de-escalated. And these are things that I understand that happen in law enforcement, but I think once you're putting out an absolute ideal of this is a Christian police force, well, by definition, that's making everybody who is not a Christian automatically a criminal, and it justifies different treatment of them than you would otherwise treat a Christian offender.
That's an interesting concept. I mean, with the kind of stuff that you find in the Bible, specifically in the way, say, prisoners or slaves or, such groups of people like wives are treated, right. It can be really atrocious, and if you're saying that your police department is guided by these principles, you're right. They will immediately treat non-Christians in a more criminal category.
Absolutely.
But would they not even treat Christians in differently in ways that might be disapproved of by our modern laws?
I would certainly imagine. And the biggest problem that I see there is that when you are an authority figure, particularly an authority figure that is armed,
yeah,
and has reasonable expectations regarding the use of force and the enforcement of law, if you want to throw in the idea that you are now a crusader or a paladin behind this, you become a very dangerous and highly motivated individual.
I think that what you bring up in terms of the marginalized groups of people in the Bible with specific protocols for treatment would have a chilling effect on someone's ability to be able to trust in the police. If the police is trusting in God, and by extension, the Christian Bible, what trust does a foreigner have who is being possibly abused by their spouse, what trust in the police department would they have in order to file a complaint and then be adequately advocated for? How about a child who may be rebellious, who wants to report that they are in an abusive situation at the hands of their parents? And if you're motivated by biblical principles in this case, what kind of advocacy can we expect? And that may sound extreme, but when you have folks that have an adherence to the Bible and a willingness to skirt our secular laws in order to put forth their own beliefs and their strong beliefs, then I don't know that it's so extreme or so off the wall to think that that might happen with individuals or with a police chief or with a police force.
No, the story is, the narrative is, and not without reason, that police departments have to be prepared to deal with extreme situations.
Absolutely.
And I think so. While bringing up extreme situations may seem strange rhetorically and a bad position, but this might, dealing with children running away from abuse is not an uncommon thing for a police officer to have to deal with, even in rural places like Tazewell County. Actually, I don't know that that's rural. That's Virginia. It could go either way. You know, where, I don't know, I just read this and I assume rural. That's my assumption.
Uh-huh.
That should be challenged. you know, that is something that any police officer should expect to deal with it several times in the course of their career. At least that's what police officers have told me. So I think that's not an extreme example.
Right. And you know, when you talk about minority communities and distrust of the police, well, I mean, those things go right along together.
Right.
Atheists are a minority community. Religions that are non-Christian are minority communities.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've already got the factors of race involved in the battle, you know, or I shouldn't say battle, in the conflict between the police and civilian populace, what would motivate a person to want to add one more filter to make the police just that much more separate from everybody else?
Right.
Why would you want to add in one more minority community? So that people who are of Islamic faiths, who may have been on the fringe of their community and felt comfortable trusting the police or calling the police when there's a good reason for it, why would you want to add just one more thing to that that says, you know what, maybe this crime goes unreported because I might be in more danger calling the police than not?
Well, what we've seen actually with the In God We Trust stickers being added to different squad cars is that in, I believe it was in Florida, one of the sheriffs actually said, no, we're doing this in order to raise our esteem in the eyes of the public in response to increased distrust, because we think the public would trust us more if they see that we're aligned with God. Well, what it does there is specifically say, who is your public? Who is
right.
The public that is being served by the police? Only those that would be comfortable by In God We Trust. And we've seen in our personal experience and in print and in comments that there is community. There is part of the community that should be protected and served by the police that is not comforted by such stickers and such declarations.
Well, it's not all bad news. For example, in Prescott, Wisconsin, Mayor Dave Hovell asked Chief of Police Guy Krutke to remove In God We Trust stickers from squad cars just days after they were affixed. Krutke took to his personal Facebook page, whose banner picture features a Confederate insignia, to complain that he had to remove the words because the bad guys might be offended by these words. Mayor Hovel clarified that his request came after consultation with insurance companies and the League of Municipalities, and not because of any complaints from the public.
And this is exactly what I'm afraid of here. When we look at this police officer who is saying the bad guys may be offended by these words. Well, he's just decided who the bad guys are.
Right.
Anyone who is offended by these words is now a criminal, is now my enemy, is now one of the bad guys.
Yeah, I'm a bad guy.
This absolutely confirms what I was what I was afraid of in the first story.
Did you guys play Cops and Robbers as kids? Did you have that at all?
No.
Okay. Well, did you play Cops and Robbers at all? Did you play, like, police officer and, you know, running away, things like that?
I played Bionic 6.
Okay. Well, generally, when children play something regarding Cops and Robbers...
Are you sure it's not just you?
Okay, maybe it's just me. Maybe it was the only kid in the entire world that played a popularized pretend game. Anyway, who do you call bad guys? Who are the bad guys and who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys and who are the good guys when kids are playing cops and robbers?
Sure, the cops are the good guys, the robbers are the bad guys.
Right, and it's kind of, there's a little thrill that you get from playing the bad guy because you're trying to take something and sneak away and run away and avoid capture, right? So that's thrilling, but you know that you're a bad guy in the context of the game.
Well, I was hesitant to answer because it's you and you like throwing me trick questions. So sometimes I just don't answer.
It's because she has a criminal mind.
She does.
She's one of the bad guys.
I do. I'm one of the bad guys. And so here's the thing. If you extend that very, very simplistic idea, you have a cop determining who's the bad guys. As you said, Dan, mm-hmm. Who are the bad guys? The atheists, maybe the Buddhists that feel alienated by this, maybe the, you know, Muslim folks that don't want to see Lord and God as applied to them.
Anybody
well,
who thinks different.
The sheriff has a Confederate symbol on his Facebook page.
Yeah, so it's his personal Facebook banner.
So I think it's pretty clear who he thinks the bad guys are here, right?
it's okay. Actually the former Georgia flag that has the Confederate
right, yeah. So
insignia on it.
I go back and I say exactly what I just said, which is I think it's pretty clear who he thinks the bad guys are here. Moving on. A county councilor from Washington State posted a poem on his personal Facebook page suggesting that evolution isn't real. David Midori from Clark County posted the poem, called Our Intelligent Designer, in two parts on his personal page, which is linked to from his official campaign page. Midori uses tired and debunked arguments throughout the poem, claims that there are holes in the evolutionary model, and suggests intelligent design is the only model that fits the facts. So I'm assuming that this poem that he's posting is 8, 10, maybe 15 years old now, because... nobody uses intelligent design anymore. That one got kind of killed.
Right.
Yeah, that's...
they're coming up with a new term.
Hey, Dave, that's not the going thing now. Come on, get with the hip crowd. All right? This is a guy we have some history with. This is Clark County, which last year I went down there twice. I, the busload of atheists from Pierce County, I was the only one.
Yeah, David Midori said...
No, that wasn't David Midori. That was...
one of the other council members?
The actual lame one.
Okay.
The one who wanted the In God We Trust sign. This guy, he was heading the committee of three.
Okay.
I
love it. Said, we have busloads of atheists coming from places like Pierce County.
And it was literally just me. So everybody took to calling me the busload.
You're the busload.
I am the busload. But he was... you know, he was trying to play fair, but he was also trying to play to his Christian base and what he perceives as a Christian base. And so he was doing stuff like this. Well, they put the sign up. You know, we lost that one because it is the motto. We are sort of at a disadvantage there. That's why people are trying to change it. Hi.
Yeah, we've got some awesome folks in the north part of our state. Robert Ray, friend of the show, he's been on a few times, and he's got the original motto project. And
and he's really cleaning up with that. If you haven't paid attention to that, you really should. It's an important thing for us. And
follow it on Facebook.
Follow it on Facebook. Follow it on Facebook. He makes he does a podcast of and he also does a lot of interviews. You should really. Follow that, and because that movement needs help, because the In God We Trust America people, who I have now spoken with to great entertainment, they have a huge head start on us.
They do. And beyond the actual organized In God We Trust America folks, you have the, you know, police officers that share things on, you know, Facebook and say, I want to do that for my squad. So
getting to this specific thing that we're talking about, which is this dumb poem. I have no problem calling it dumb. He's allowed to do this, yes? This is not like a breaking the law thing, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It just shows us where our motivations of our elected officials are.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I guess there's nothing wrong with posting poetry on Facebook. Although I specifically like the just tired old arguments because it shows one of the really clear definitions or boundaries, perhaps, between intelligent design and the actual pursuit of science. Science is constantly advancing, constantly.
Right.
Well, these intelligent design arguments are 200 years old.
Right.
There's nothing new coming up here.
The only thing, I mean, intelligent design is a fresh coat of paint on some very old ideas.
Right.
I mean, we've only been talking about intelligent design since the late 90s. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is wedge document stuff, right? This is back from, they're up here. What are they called? The Discovery Institute?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, literally.
They haven't actually discovered anything.
No, that's great. That's what I love about it. They call themselves the Discovery Institute. They're up there. Their headquarters are up in Seattle. They're most known to the atheist community for a wedge document, which was basically if we shove a wedge of misunderstanding of evolution into the scientific community, there's a boatload of Christian stuff behind it we can continue to shove, which.
Right.
I mean, everybody, you know what's funny about that is I saw that and I'm like, yes. Like, a lot of people were just up in arms, like, oh my God, this is terrible. Oh, it's horrible. Can't you believe it? And I'm like, they weren't hiding this. This is what they do.
This is what they do.
This is their job. And so it's not, wasn't that surprising to me. Is it gross? Absolutely. Because they want to replace inquiry with dogma. And that's never a good thing.
I still find that, just that idea, sort of personally puzzling. Like, okay, so you know that the evidence goes this way. You know that all the facts that stack up, they kind of push towards the scientific argument, towards the evolution argument. And because you know that there is more and better evidence on the evolution side, now you decide that you have to fight really hard for the creation side. It's like, but see, that breaks me as a scientist personally. I'm just like, I just don't get it. When you have more and better evidence on one side, you don't decide that you need to defend the other side even harder. You just go, oh, I guess I was wrong. Okay, I'll work on the other one then.
So, Becky, you've been you've been following this too. So, you know, back me up on this or tell me where I'm wrong. But, Dan, I've seen two groups of people who follow this argument, where one side is, I've got things pretty good. I get to control the lives of hundreds of people, and it's pretty nice. And it depends on this particular dogma. And any challenge to this dogma unseats my social control. Therefore, I'm going to fight it tooth and nail, and inquiry and the betterment of humanity be damned.
Maybe I've been giving them too much credit for compassion.
Yeah, that's the thing. But that's only one side. And that may even be the minority. The other side is the, I have based so much of my morality and my identity on this thing that any serious challenge to it would cause me to question the whole thing. So I'd rather we just not question it.
I think that at least with David Midori or the author of this poem, that latter one is the one that you hit the nail on the head with him.
With David Midori, I am not so certain.
You're not so certain?
Maybe he's trying to
give the impression that it's the latter.
Right. I mean, because he is a politician, and he is definitely playing the Christian card in order to get voter attention. That was very obvious in my interactions with him, and this seems like more of the same. So in the case of David Midori, I'd say no, actually, from my perspective, he's more the social control than the personal identity side of it.
Then maybe speaking to the folks that
Not that it's necessarily either or. I shouldn't put it that way.
Maybe trying to speak to the voices and those for whom, if they came across this other evidence, it would totally shake their identity. Because you have lines in the poem that are things like, psyllium blood clotting the immune system too. How could this evolve? No one had a clue. And
oh,
Dan,
so you have the poem.
Oh, yes, I do. It's
wow, that even rhymed with the last line.
Exactly. All it is a treatise on any number of folks that doubt doubt evolution and doubt our knowledge of this, just put with rhymes. There's not even really any good meter or anything like that.
You know,
like
I say
that.
This, I don't know the guy personally. It'd be nice if one of our listeners or one of the members of the community down in Clark County could talk to him and address his concerns and see what he comes with after that, because I think that could be interesting. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're going to break. When we come back, we got some pretty cool emails about, actually stuff exactly like this, science and the like.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
48 hours, 24 hours, 10 minutes to go.
The motorcade appears to have stopped, and yes, it appears as though the governor is getting out now. It's hard to see. My God, the rain is it's coming down in sheets. I've never seen anything like this. There must be tens of thousands of people out here right now. The streets are shut down. Okay, it appears the governor is making his way toward the convention center. No one knows what he's going to say. The crowd is pushing forward through the storm. The Secret Service is struggling to hold them back. A wave of people are rushing toward the candidate. My God.
Zero. For your consideration, we present Convention and its subject, the nominee. ANNEXRadio.com. Now on iTunes and Stitcher.
Secular humanism is a non-theistic view of the universe built on a foundation of reason, science, and democracy. Humanists support intellectual freedom and critical thinking, and we hold that human beings are autonomous centers of moral development. The Humanists of Washington is the oldest humanist organization in the state and offers a community of free thinkers who educate the public and celebrate life. For information on how you can be a part of the humanist activities in the Puget Sound area, become a member of the Humanists of Washington today. Visit humanistsofwashington.org.
Ask an Atheist may have gone on the road, but we're not making big bucks.
We still need to keep the lights on, and 95% of our costs are for airtime alone.
That's why we need your contributions.
If you've got something to advertise, consider Ask an Atheist in your ad budget.
Our listener Peggy said it best. Step up and contribute to keep secular voices on the air. For $5, you could have a latte or a moment of science.
Take on Peggy's challenge and contribute today.
For details, go to askanatheist.tv or contribute directly via PayPal to paypal@askanatheist.tv.
At Puget Sound Celebrant Service, we want to be your secular wedding officiant. We are committed to serving the Puget Sound region and work to ensure your special day is all about you. Robert, a certified humanist celebrant with the Humanist Society, specializes in secular weddings and customizes ceremonies to fit your needs. To commemorate your special day, each couple married by Robert will receive a one-year membership to the American Humanist Association. Find out more at PugetSoundCelebrant.com.
Welcome back! This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. So I got some people to thank. I'd like to thank Adam from Milwaukee and Richard from Kent Actual for meeting Peggy's challenge. Peggy's challenge is the challenge to listeners of Ask an Atheist to help us keep the lights on. You can go to askanatheist.tv, click on the yellow button on the right-hand side, take you right to our PayPal page. Every dollar you give us goes directly towards show production. And I actually have a little note to attach to that. We are in the middle of trying to attract new advertisers to the show and sort of help keep us on the air. So if you listen to us, especially if you listen to us over the air as a radio show, I'd love to get a message from you guys that I can pass on to potential advertisers. That would be fantastic. Just email us at questions@askanatheist.tv and let us know you appreciate the show. I think that would be a good thing for, I think, everybody all around right now. So we have some emails. The first email comes to us from Jeff from Virginia, who writes, I was listening to a recent episode where you discussed a cross-shaped memorial in Maryland. In the show, you discussed the secularness of the cross being demonstrated by the inclusion of an American Legion crest. Not only did the judge apparently fall for this, but so did that week's hosts. The American Legion is a lot of things, but secular it is most definitely not. I discovered this after my wife was witness to a flag-folding ceremony demonstrated at her elementary school on Memorial Day last year. A group came in, folded a flag, and spouted off a word salad where each of the 12 folds stood for a different religious principle. Actually, Becky, you found that document. There's some weirdness in it. Just give us a quick idea of what it is.
Man, I mean, it says that each of them is representing a religious principle on which our great country was originally founded. You have things like where our hearts lie. You have things like our country in dealing with other countries. May she always be right and never wrong.
I have to admit that that was a failure on my part, because I actually, in my In God We Trust talk that I did at the Atheist Alliance of America thing, I actually talk about the Foreign Legion. The American Legion for a few minutes.
Yeah, they actually, in some regions, paid specifically to frame posters that say In God We Trust to put in every single elementary school classroom in certain districts and things like that. I mean, looking at them closer, they have written amicus briefs and other documents in favor of bills that would allow for public religious expression on the parts of government officials.
Yeah, so I don't know who said it, but that's definitely my failure, because I knew it and didn't say anything about it. Sorry about that, Jeff from Virginia, and thank you for pointing it out to us. So our next email comes to us from Jesse from Mesa, Arizona, who writes, I recently watched a documentary called The Unbelievers, which follows Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss in their mission to promote atheism to the world. At many points, they say that religion should be eradicated and religious people are inherently uneducated. I want to know why they think this. I think that I am a rational, scientifically minded person. I'm also a religious Jew. I don't understand how the two are in conflict. If anything, my religion makes me more scientifically minded, as I believe I am charged to wrestle with and question God and the world around me. I understand that historically it may have been an issue, but in our modern world, I don't see why science and religion can't coexist. Thank you for your answer. I'll let you have first crack at this one.
You want to spearhead this thing? Okay.
Yeah.
So here's a thing that I try to... try to make clear, I guess. You can be a scientist and you can be a religious person, not at the same time. If you're going to do both, you will have to compartmentalize.
Right.
Because if you're applying real scientific principles, scientific method to religion, any religion that is based on faith, that is based on mythology, falls apart very quickly. And the difficulty there is in scientific thought, you don't go in looking for the facts that support your position.
Yeah.
You go in looking at the facts and letting them lead you to a position. And then that position is changeable. It is not set in stone. It's not written down on tablets. It is changeable. And conversely, so you really can't apply scientific thought to religion other than sort of as a theological study in kind of an anthropology way. But the same problems occur if you apply your religion to your scientific endeavors.
Right.
I'm a scientist. I work in a lab. If I start using religion to predict the outcomes of my experiments or to design my studies, I will fail. My results will be inconsistent because I'm going in with an idea of what I think should happen. I've got a predisposition. I feel that one of my ideas is the favorite idea, or I'm looking for data that supports this religious ideal. And I know many scientists that are religious people, and of them, the most responsible, the most effective, and the most well-published, frankly, are the ones that compartmentalize, that they, you know, much like their clothing, coming out of the lab, they leave their lab coat on the hook going out.
Right.
Coming in, they leave their religion on the hook outside the lab.
And
that's just how it has to be done if you're going to be both.
I would put it a little bit differently in that I think that kind of compartmentalization is a classification of cognitive dissonance. And I don't think one can be religious in be a specific kind of religious, but I think in order to be religious and be scientific, it requires some level of cognitive dissonance, whether it be compartmentalization or something else. Now, that sounds like I'm actually challenging your intellect when I say that. I'm actually not, because I think it takes a lot of intellectual gumption to maintain that kind of cognitive dissonance in a positive way.
Right. And we all compartmentalize all the time.
Yeah, and I also think this cognitive dissonance with religious people extends beyond science, because otherwise, why would I be able to say that people are better than their religions? Because they have to, because they see this book, and this book says, copy this book exactly, this book will tell you how to run your life, and then it's got a bunch of crazy stuff in it, all of them, every single one of them has some crazy stuff in it, but somehow humanity figures out that some of that crazy stuff probably isn't a good idea. And that's your intellect making the world a better place right there. And that's what I'm talking about. But I think increasingly, as we get to understand our universe better and better, figure out how it was put together, how it was formed, you know, what particular type of glue, whether it be, you know, super glue, hot glue,
or gluons.
Yeah. You know, that was used. By nobody. it starts to challenge religious faith in ways that science did not previously. And I think that's where it's going to fall apart.
I think one of the things that Jesse might be struggling with is coming from a contemporary Jewish perspective. And when you're not part of an Orthodox community, when you're part of the modern American progressive Jewish community, you're looking at something, a kind of practice of your religion that isn't faith-based. And that's something that for majority religious folks in the U.S., or even non-believers to look at, is a little bit alien. That the Jewish religion doesn't require a declaration of faith. And so
I would challenge that.
And so many... May I
go ahead,
continue the exploration? The way that Jesse said that her religion motivates her to wrestle with questions of the world around her and God is something that I'm very familiar with, because I grew up being raised in that kind of thing, where the expectation was that you learn, you study, you become knowledgeable, and you question at all times. And so it can sound and feel very scientific at times. And one of the things that I was very motivated by in my adolescence and in my 20s was sort of this marriage of looking at, as we learn more scientific facts, or as science helps us discover more things about our universe or about the state of biology or the state of neuroscience, it confirmed things that I thought were promoted in the ancient writings.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you have, or not even so ancient, but you have the Zohar, and you say it looks like, you know, in the beginning everything was light, right? Well, that's an ancient writing by modern standards, and we say, hey, that confirms what scientists learned about the Big Bang.
Sure.
And looking at that, it's very nice, and it's a nice way to sort of marry those two things, but looking to science to confirm a belief doesn't work. I mean, that's wholly unscientific.
This may be right. A conversation for another day, but much like when I said, you know, what kind of glue was used by nobody, and I question you saying that there's no faith involved, I think we're looking mostly at a failure of language. Our language fails us here, where when we talk about faith in the context of this show, or as you talk about faith in the context of describing being a religious Jew, maybe it's not faith in the way that we consider faith in a modern American Christian context, but I think there's still a buy-in where you kind of have, there's a dogma that you have to have in order for other things to sort of fall into place. There's basically a kernel at the bottom that you just have to go with as a religious Jew.
And I would agree to that.
And that, to me, is faith.
I would also agree with that, and it's actually implicit here in the statement. I don't understand how the Turing conflict, if anything, my religion makes me more scientifically minded, as I believe I am charged to wrestle with and question God and the world around me. If you are scientifically minded, for what reason are you wrestling with the question of God any more than you might be wrestling with the question of any other potentially fictitious thing?
The thing is, it doesn't say wrestling God, it says wrestling with God. It's right. Who are you wrestling, I guess, becomes a question there.
And that's exactly my point.
Yeah.
I'm not going to wrestle Darth Vader, because I don't have empirical evidence for the existence of Darth Vader other than a handful of action figures. So if you're being purely scientific, the problem here is going in with this hypothesis, this idea that there is in fact a God to wrestle with, when the empirical evidence does not support that. And if you're going to be an honest scientist, you can't even start with the question of, am I wrestling with God?
Mm-hmm.
The question would be, am I wrestling?
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
And if you determine that the evidence shows that you are in fact wrestling, am I wrestling with what? What is it that I am wrestling with? You can't start with, I am wrestling with God.
And this is the part where I think faith enters into it, even if it's not popularly identified as faith. Is that the assumption here that she is making, that is that she is wrestling with God on these issues. I don't know who she's wrestling with in this case. So unfortunately, that's all the time we've got to get right to the top of the hour. My name is Sam. Thank you, Becky. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Dave, who did the writing. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv, email us at questions@askanatheist.tv, Twitter us at askanatheistwa. We're actually hanging out on YouTube a bit more with clips of our show on channel AskAnAtheistWA. That's all the time we've got for today. We're happy to be back on the radio. See you guys next week. In your next visit to the universe, consider things. Things. They're important to you. Welcome back. We're not on the air anymore. We're not radiating. Well, I imagine if you had an infrared camera, you might disagree.
Yeah. Slightly more spectra than that, in fact.
Yeah. Really? I thought it was mostly infrared.
Mostly infrared.
Like what else?
Well, there's going to be some near infrared, there's going to be some microwave, and there's going to be some radio.
What's the microwave coming from? Molecular stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really?
Breaking chlorine bonds. We're doing it.
Oh, yeah. Duh. All right. So in the last segment of the radio show, we were talking about this email that I had in front of me until I closed my browser like a knob.
Was that Jesse from Arizona?
Jesse from Arizona. This is not... We could circle the drain on this one all day. I feel like we should talk about it a little bit more because we hit the artificial barrier of the end of the show. But we're going to circle the drain on this for a long time, I think. What's that?
One thing I do really want to address is Lawrence Krauss and Richard Dawkins implying that all people who are religious are inherently uneducated.
Yeah, I don't necessarily have to agree with that. There are certainly a lot of uneducated religious people out there. I mean, just open a book. Well, they won't. No.
They'll open one book.
They'll open one.
That was pretty good, guys.
I hope that the mics picked up that high five.
I believe they did. I mean, we could circle this one for a long time, but also I don't like the word eradicate while we're talking about the way that's being portrayed.
What is the etymological origin of the word eradicate?
Radic meaning root, so to remove at the root, to cut at the root.
Cut off at the root.
Well, if we're talking about it from a word perspective, yeah, I guess I don't have a problem with the word eradicate, but...
I didn't realize I was eradicating radishes every time I make a salad.
You are eradishing them, yes. Radish comes from root.
Yeah,
yes.
I get
but
that.
Much like the word decimate...
We're not reducing by a tenth.
Yeah, it's not... Well, nobody uses... Like, the only people who use decimate to mean by a tenth are people... Who
are pedants.
Yeah, are people who know what it means.
Pedants.
Yeah, which is... I use the word decimate. I do not mean reduce by a tenth. I'll say decimate, and then I'll look at the numbers and go, oh, wait, no, actually, I was right.
Is it to reduce by one-tenth or to reduce to one-tenth?
By one-tenth.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a...
Then decimate the, is less than... Then you're left still left with 90% of everything.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not actually that bad. Our forces were decimated.
The folk etymology, I don't know if this is real or not, is that it was used as a punishment among Roman legions, where if you had a legion that or a brigade that was being a jerk, you just would kill 10% of them and go, okay, stop, knobs.
I am unfamiliar with that story, but
under
I like
the context of punishment, it sounds a lot more frightening than it did a minute ago.
Yeah, I think that's why decimate doesn't really mean what it means. Oh my god, this is annoying. So I don't like the implications of the word eradicate because it suggests something a lot more guns.
like then carpet bombing.
Yeah.
Like considering human beings as pests.
Yeah. Something like that. I don't like that.
It's a spooky word.
But if we're talking about eradicate in its original meaning, yeah, that's fine. Because I think one way to tell if your religion has truth is to not teach it to children.
And see if people arrive at it later on.
Yeah. It's why not, you know, if go ahead.
No, apparently me and Becky have synced up all of our commentary.
Okay, Borg. you were talking about this in pre-show, is you don't want religion taught to children.
Right. Yeah, I think if you're going to teach an idea to someone, they should be at a place where they can examine the idea. And I think if you're starting out by teaching children dogma, things that don't have evidence behind them, and in my personal opinion are not particularly useful, but do cause significant amounts of harm, psychological harm, guilt, grief, fear, that kind of thing. If you're going to try and teach that idea to someone, they should be an adult that's capable of thinking about it critically. And if it stands up to critical thought, then the idea can be said to be as close as we can get to true. But if it does not stand up to critical thought, then don't teach it as fact. Teach it as mythology. Teach it as an interesting anecdote of humanity's history.
So how about then the question of, when you have very small children, the kinds of traditions that you have that are embedded both in one's culture and can bond one's child to themselves and to previous generations, but aren't necessarily about belief. So holidays that, since Jesse writes in as a religious Jew, holidays that are not observed by the dominant culture, but connect one to their past. So looking at things like Purim, right? Halloween is a dominant cultural holiday, but Purim is not. The general American populace does not celebrate Purim.
The reason we can't say don't teach religion to kids is because if we don't teach kids about religion, somebody else will, and it may not go the way we want. And that's kind of what I'm this you're bringing up all those holidays is kind of bringing me into it, is I can't create an environment on Earth where people aren't going to learn about holidays, and that is a problem.
I'm not sure I follow.
Okay, go on.
How do you then say can you not teach the concepts of faith or belief without evidence and things like that until a child is about 13, 14, or 18, things like that? Then how do you refrain from doing that while also connecting someone to one's culture? And is the thing that we're asking to say, no, cut that off? Can you not teach about holidays that maybe aren't based on belief?
This is the one where I get in trouble, and my answer to that is that absolutely necessary?
Exactly. I mean, that is the question that's there. Can you create your own traditions? Is there a harm in saying, and I think the answer is, of course, you can create your own traditions, but are you willing to cut that kind of continuity with ones with those that come before you?
I think a good analogy, an analogy that's been made many times, is that of Santa Claus. Santa Claus is a pervasive idea in American culture, and you know, it may come as a shock to the other kids when you don't believe in Santa anymore. But when I was a kid, you know, I went through a phase where everybody sort of talked about Santa like this was this real thing, and then as I got a little bit older, one of my parents or relatives, I don't remember which, explained to me that, well, Santa's not actually real in the sense that things like, you know, gravity are real. But this is a game that we sort of play, and it's a fun game, and everybody kind of plays along, and we all know what the real deal is here. But we do it because it's fun and because the littler kids really enjoy it. And what really started this was I started, as a very young kid, I started thinking about science and the limitations of physics. And you've got this guy who can go to, you know, every house in a single night. And it's like, well, how can a person actually do this? And the answer is, of course, magic. And my young mind even then was like, yeah, but magic's make-believe. And so when I started asking questions about limitations on the speed of light or the number of people who are good kids that believe in Santa Claus, and how can you possibly fit this much time into a time period, the thing totally fell apart to me. And I needed an explanation of why are we still doing this, because it's obviously not a possible thing. And I think that the way that it was addressed to me was a pretty healthy way, where it's like, well, it's not real, but it is important, and it's this game, and it's about a sense of belonging, and we're all playing along, and it's fun, so let's just run with it. But no, it's not real.
Well, and part of what I was talking about is before that I don't think I explained very well is, even if you don't decide to teach like some cultural ideals to kids, because you're worried about filling their heads with ideas that may not work, somebody else is going to, if you have them living not inside of a Tupperware container. And so the idea of not teaching kids anything is not an effectively good idea. It's not something that you can actually do. Not have them be kids on Earth. You'd have to do it on a space station or something. And that's going to screw them up in 15 different other ways.
So when kids are 3 and 4 years old and you're celebrating Hanukkah, or you're celebrating Purim and dressing up, and you say, we do this because it's fun and because it's nice and because it's a way to connect with our family, and it's a way when grandpa and grandma come by the house and friends come by the house and we make foods that are specific to this particular holiday. But how does that then interact with parents who are religious and do have that belief?
Where I'd like to take that is, I do not believe the idea that we should connect kids to culture, to a culture, is not, I don't think it's challenged quite enough. We assume it's a good thing. We assume it has positive things. I assume that it has good and positive things, but does it really? Because there is significant evidence that maybe it's not so great.
I think particularly within the Jewish community, at least the one that I grew up with, it was very apparent that there was a near obsession, unhealthy obsession with Jewish continuity in terms of a fear of what happens if that continuity is broken. It's echoed in the Jewish musical of all time, which is Fiddler on the Roof, right? You have right. An entire, the Hallmark keynote. Yeah, exactly.
Tradition.
Song is tradition. But you also had this fear of needing to replace all of those that perished in the Holocaust, because that was something that we had a duty to make up for. And I think that, yes, when you had that idea of being challenged, of connection to one's past, that was something that was very, very, very skeptically held and very fearfully held.
I don't think it was skeptically held.
You were viewed with skepticism.
Oh, okay.
If that was something that you wanted to challenge.
Because the other side of that is the reason why a lot of communities are held in disdain by the larger community is cultural, is inherited. I mean, it kind of cuts both ways. And I don't think that's something we're willing to discuss in the concept of promoting culture in America, is that culture does provide a lot of strength where strength may be needed, but it also provides a lot of anger where anger is most definitely not needed.
I would agree to both of those things. I would caution, though, is if your minority culture is being viewed with disdain, I would say by the majority culture, I would say that that's not necessarily a reason for you to challenge your continuity.
Yeah, see, I would want to have this general, like, if we were to develop a generic operating manual for human beings, that would be the context in which you'd want to have it, because... Which makes it maybe an impossible discussion to have, because if you have it on any other context, it's going to be you're going to have to bring in actual. You're going to insult a lot of people, and I don't actually mean to insult. I just want to know, and that brings us back to the science thing. Is what if I sociologically wanted to study this? Is culture actually a good thing? If I'm coming in with a base culture, if I'm coming in with a dogmatic belief, that would compromise, I think, in many ways, how I would approach that sort of study.
Definitely. I think studying anthropology has got to be one of the most difficult and underappreciated endeavors in science. It is so astoundingly difficult to come in as a blank slate. I don't think it's even possible, which is why you have to make sure that not just your research subjects, but the researchers themselves are as diverse and unbiased as possible.
Yeah.
In order to get any sort of fair assessment. But even still, when we're looking at an idea like, is a sense of belonging to a culture a positive thing? Even beginning to deconstruct that and figure out how to build a study is incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
And especially to be objective in it. So when we're looking at, is it a good thing? So first we have to come up with, well, what is a good thing? What is objectively good? Are we talking about biological reproduction, propagation of the species? Are we talking about economic increases? Are we talking about physical health or psychological health and well-being? Are we talking about international politics? I mean, the question gets out of hand so quickly, it may not actually be a study that is doable.
I don't know.
But if there's an anthropologist
out there. I'm
almost
certain that it isn't. Yeah, I'm nearly certain. But it's one of those huge questions that are going to be in my head, which are going to have to remain unanswered for all time, because I don't think there's a meaningful way to actually answer that question. And any meaningful way that I could construct would likely harm a lot of people. And I have no interest in harming people for the sake of answering a dumb question.
Right. Sometimes treating people like numbers works very well for getting information.
Yeah.
And other times it's a terrible, terrible idea.
But I guess my point is that when you deal with science, a lot of, and this is me sort of turning it around, is that when I ask questions that are important to me and I want to solve them scientifically, there's a lot of tiny places for my preconceptions to sort of seep in and completely color anything I might do. And that's going to be true for anybody.
Absolutely.
But I think what we've discovered is that it seems to be doubly true for a lot of religious people, lot of religious people in science. And I think that's a large part of the reason why people like Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss, two people who are in scientific fields of endeavor where there is the most conflict with religion, might see that as a lack of education. From their perspective, it might very well be.
Right.
But I can't really have this discussion without bringing up Kenneth Miller. I can't. It's really important.
Fill me in on who Kenneth Miller is.
The Kitzmiller trial. He's a scientist. He's a geneticist, and he's a Roman Catholic. And he was instrumental in defeating the Discovery Institute and Michael Behe specifically in the intelligent design debate. And on our, on quote unquote our side, we had the atheists, we had the humanists, we had people who were pro-science, and we had a fair number of religious people who have successfully figured out how to compartmentalize and do. And Kenneth Miller does. I mean, he's world renowned, not just now for two reasons, where before it was just one. And that's the kind of person we're talking about here. And I think a lot of atheists who have this discussion without talking about with these people, I think that makes it a little disingenuous. Now, there's the other side of that where the other example everybody likes to bring up is Isaac Newton, who was quote unquote a scientist and a religious person.
Right.
I actually think at the end of the day, he was kind of terrible at it. he totally let his, the only thing that saved him is that he was working in math where it's really easy to cook that out. But if you look at his other fields of, if you look at his total scientific output.
Didn't he believe in alchemy?
It's a lot of alchemy, a lot of end of days crap, a lot of, I mean, he was.
Especially towards the end of his life, perhaps because he had done so much alchemy.
Yeah. it sound like heroin.
I'm not kidding. What I'm saying is they didn't know a lot about the toxicity of heavy metals, and the more interesting a metal was, like mercury, for instance, the more often it was used.
Yeah.
Because this is a metal, but it's a liquid. There must be something inherently strange and interesting about that. And mercury is certainly strange and interesting, but not to the point where you'd like to, sit over something that is vaporizing it and inhale the fumes.
Or juggle it, or drink it.
Yeah.
Or this is all stuff people have done.
There are safe ways to take mercury into their body. Breathing it is not one of them.
Yeah, especially when it's the elemental type and not bound up in something.
And if you're listening to me at home and considering doing anything with mercury, let me restate that. There are, in fact, no safe ways to put mercury into your body. But if you're actually interested in biochemistry, yeah, there totally are.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I do, completely different note.
There needs to be like a scientific warning music that plays while you do that.
Don't eat that food. It's full of chemicals.
Yeah. As I've said on the show before, I occasionally do remedial science courses at my high school. And I encounter a lot of students who just haven't been exposed to a lot of ideas that would contradict their religious upbringings. And so one of the things we get around is science asks questions that could be testable. And religion deals with lots of questions that are very important for your values, for your family, for your beliefs and how you live your life, but that not all of your religious questions are testable.
Yet.
And so, right. And so when we can ask a testable question, then we can apply science to it. So sometimes the answers that we discover to those testable questions might make us redetermine what our religious questions were.
Mm.
So the exemplar, I think, let me know if this is a bad, but I think the exemplar argument that atheists have about religious people in science could be identified with my relationship with the candy lemon heads.
I'm intrigued.
Okay.
Go on.
I really like lemon heads.
Did you know they're made of chemicals?
Yes, they are made of chemicals. And some of them are not particularly good chemicals. But, like some acids. I mean, ooh, that's
like
bad.
Citric acid.
Yeah, citric acid. Oh, my God. Well, I mean, I really, really like it as a candy. And it has made my life better.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. when I was young and I was smoking, I needed something. I quit smoking cold turkey and successfully did so, at least once, by basically switching cigarettes for lemon heads, because at the time they were cheap. A huge bag of them was $1.
Wow.
And so instead of...
He did say he was young.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago.
I did spend, instead of spending $3 or $4 on a pack of cigarettes, I would buy a bag of I'd buy a bag of lemon heads and just pop one in my mouth throughout the day. And that actually, other than like the shaking and sweating and stuff like that, that thoroughly circumvented my nicotine fixation.
Hmm.
And so I feel like, I have, maybe you could say, I have faith in lemon heads. Now I am a food scientist or a chemicalologist or something.
Chemicalologist.
And I have to do a study about lemon heads, and I discover that lemon heads is full of like cyanide or something like that, full of bad.
Okay, let's be clear. This is a hypothetical.
Yes, this is a hypothetical.
Lemon heads are not full of cyanide.
No.
Sam is not a chemicalologist.
I am certainly not a chemicalologist. I don't even know how to say it.
But you have such high appreciation, high esteem for lemon heads, even to this day, even though they don't need, you don't need them to not smoke. You
right.
just like them now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They improve the quality of your life. They don't really hurt anyone else that you're eating them.
Honestly, I could say with some honesty that I would feel really terrible and would hesitate if I had to go to the world that, or as you put it in the pre-show, eating lemon heads is worse than smoking 6 packs of cigarettes a day.
Right. Yeah. No,
yeah.
It is not. But yeah.
It is not. But if I had that information, I would be compromised a little bit in that position. I don't have representatives from the Ferrara Pan Corporation
mm-hmm.
coming into my house and saying, don't you say terrible things about lemon heads. Don't you say terrible
you
things.
You might
about
now.
Maybe. But religious people regularly are being told that they have to participate in, something or, please, don't say bad things about religion.
Right.
Especially if they're a scientist dealing in evolution or quantum physics as Lawrence.
Absolutely. So it would seem like less of a personal pressure and more of a societal pressure in that regard.
Do I have my finger on it or am I just out my own deal?
No, I think you're there. And
okay.
One of the difficult things being involved in science is having to constantly reevaluate the things that you think.
Mm-hmm.
There were some ecological remediation methods that I thought were the bee's knees 6 months ago and have since learned that, no, that's a terrible idea.
Right. Got one on tap? I'm actually curious.
It's the issue is still a little bit on fire,
uh-huh.
and so I'm going to leave that one for now and move to a different sort of fire altogether. One of the things that I personally loved all of my life and still love is wood smoke fires.
Campfires
are wonderful. I used to heat my house with a wood burning stove and I loved it. I loved the smell, I loved the feel of it, I loved the process of starting the fire in the stove and feeling the whole home warm up and that kind of thing. And
so how good are they, Dan, for the environment and for humans and for people and for neighborhoods?
Not good at all. I did some research on it. Somebody just sort of challenged me on it and said, well, what do you think is in wood smoke? And I, you know, I honestly, I don't know. I haven't thought about it. And in the course of this research, learned that wood smoke is significantly more carcinogenic than tobacco smoke, that it tends to hang in the air longer and stay in the neighborhood longer. The amount of greenhouse gases that are released is worse than diesel smoke. That areas where you have high instances of wood-heated homes, you also have high instances of childhood asthma and lung disease, and that basically a wood fire is a terrible, terrible thing, even compared to like a coal fire, as far as the actual health and safety
of it. I feel like there's got to be a catch there.
And so I had to look at this evidence and give up something that I really enjoyed and say, like, you know, I cannot honestly and ethically have a wood fire to heat my home anymore. And I ended up using the thing that I hated about that house was it had oil heat, which is why I used the wood burning stove, because, you know, I'm not a big proponent of fossil fuels. But when I look at the actual fact of the matter and the environmental and health and safety harm that's done by the wood fire, I had to concede that the diesel oil heating was in fact safer and more ecologically responsible than the wood
fire. Safer, definitely. I mean, I like occasional campfires, but if I'm around too many of them, I get a splitting headache.
Yeah.
So great. Apparently, I have a horrible ecology detector in my brain. But I feel like there's got to be some catch between oil and wood fire as far as the ecological end of it goes.
Well, wood is, of course, a renewable resource.
Is that it?
Basically, yeah.
Oh.
Or versus, you know, locally sourced as well. So the transport involved and the extraction of the oil involved versus your harm to your immediate locality.
Right.
I saw some of the studies that looked at when you have inversion layers in the wintertime. So Phoenix, Arizona gets an inversion layer. Salt Lake City gets inversion layers where you have the cold air pressing down and trapping a lot of the pollutants in valleys and cities and things like that. And the contributions that wood smoke and wood-burning fires make, rivaling car exhaust, mm-hmm. and the impact to your immediate locality, which was quite striking.
So to wrap up this discussion, I feel like since this is not a conversation for some sort of tactical victory, mm-hmm. but it's a conversation of what I hope is understanding, I don't feel like I've done the entire job. And I don't think I could do that in 90 weeks, let alone 90 minutes. But there's one aspect of this that I think defeats that, why, in spite of the amount of religious people in science, why we still think the science, scientific method works. And I think this is something all parties could agree on. And Dan, I'm going to hand this for you to the wrap up, or to you for the wrap up, if you uh-huh. will. Repeatability.
Repeatability. Absolutely. I don't recall who said it, but it was once said, it was Penn Jillette.
Yeah.
If you wiped out all of the religious texts on Earth, you would never, ever get them back the same way. If you wiped out all of the scientific knowledge on Earth, you would eventually get all of it back. You might be using a base 12 system instead of a base 10. You might be using a different constant in some equations, but we'd figure out gravity. We would figure out light. We would figure out electromagnetism just the same as we did the first time. And that's really the thing about it. Science works because it is objectively true and as close to a value of true as we can get, which is to say consistent with all of the available evidence. And when evidence arises that is inconsistent, generally we first question the evidence. But as inconsistent evidence piles up, we have to change our mind. We have to develop a new understanding, just like going from Newtonian physics to quantum physics, just like going from, you know, rubber sheet theory of gravity to gravitational waves, or from going from Lamarckian ideas of evolution to Darwinian ideas of evolution to modern ideas of evolution, which actually incorporate a little bit from both. We had the same thing going from genomics to genetics to epigenetics, and everything that's gone on in the past 10 years going past epigenetics. All this stuff would come back the same way because it is testable. It is repeatable. Peer review is what it comes down to.
And that's why it works.
And that's why it works.
And that's why you would discover that my candy is horrible, even if I discovered it first, is because it's repeatable.
It's repeatable.
But it re- Oh my God, I want to close this out, but you brought up a really good point.
Go.
It goes back to our discussion of objective morality. Believe it or not, is I think if you wiped out all human knowledge and we had to start over, the religions would be completely different. They'd all have different names. They'd all eat at different restaurants, and they might not even be restaurants. But I think there are certain moral particulars that would probably persist, like nobody likes being murdered.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say that this repetition has already occurred. We aren't the only social species that has a standard code of behavior. In fact, I think my second moment of science, back when it was still a moment of science, was in fact about that. The evolution of morality and the fact that it has evolved in not just this species, but many species. Human beings, elephants, wolves, cetaceans, ants, termites, colonial shrimps. There are thousands of examples of species that have a code of behavior relating to their conspecifics, members of their own species, and in some cases, members of other species that benefit all of them to pass on the most successful genes, to build the most successful defense system or the most successful food acquisition system. These same things come up over and over and over. And I think we would find that as long as we remained a social species, an intelligent social species, if all of the texts of our morality were wiped out, we would get the gist of, you know, do unto others, don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, don't cheat. These things would all come up again, and they have many times, yeah. not just many different human cultures that for all practical purposes evolved independently on different continents, but in fact for many non-human species that have evolved completely independently of us, in some cases predating us by hundreds of millions of years.
Cool. Well, we're so thank you very much for this email, Jesse. This is a subject that, if you haven't figured out, is actually fairly important to me, because I think it's part of where the rubber meets the road as far as how I deal with religious people and what my opinions on them are. Because you can kind of see it gets kind of global as we discuss it. But while we're waxing poetic, Becky, you had some other information we couldn't cover in the radio show regarding what we talked about today.
Oh, my God. David Medor down in Clark County on his personal Facebook page composed a poem. Apparently, it's by him, and it does recycle.
Oh, it is by him.
I think it says, Our Intelligent Designer, a poem by me, part one. But here's the thing. Dave is our writer for the show, and he did say it drags out old, tired, and debunked, easily explainable arguments about this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you want me to read it? I mean, do you want me to read it and then you pick it apart? I don't know. That might get tiresome, guys.
How long is it?
Well, part one, I don't know. Several verses.
There's stanzas.
Several stanzas, verses. Let me take a few out there. So we've got, let's see. Shocked and dumbfounded, we hadn't expected molecular machines fine-tuned and perfected. So complex were the workings, parts perfectly fitted, that we had to admit that we were completely outwitted. Rotary engines that spin the flagellum. How'd the parts get there? But no one could tell 'em. Fantastic, complex, ingenious machines, software and hardware pre-programmed in genes.
Okay, so, He goes on for several stanzas about irreducible complexity.
Yes, this whole poem is about irreducible complexity.
The whole thing's about irreducible complexity.
That also nobody knows how this could possibly evolve. Everyone couldn't see. No, everyone's outwitted. Everyone's dumbfounded. We tried to see more scientific things. We conducted more experiments, and we were just further baffled to the point where we say this has to be the work of an intelligent designer.
Right. Strangely enough, this is really cool, because the best refutation of this argument can be found in the Kitzmiller trial from Kenneth Miller, because that's what Michael Behe was all about.
Oh, he even references Behe in his poem.
Yeah, he's the guy who came up with who I don't know if he came up with it, but he definitely, with the Darwin's black box thing, he's definitely the guy who came up with this irreducible complexity argument as we know it in modern times. Kenneth Miller came up and was like, okay, here are the problems with it. Here's why irreducible complexity in a singular organism isn't actually irreducibly complex. Here's why it doesn't fall apart.
And we can hypothesize why these things evolved, right?
Yeah. One of the ways that I like to look at irreducible complexity is by example, let's start with the eye. Human eyes, very complex. Cephalopod eyes, also very complex. Superior in some aspects, equal in others, inferior in others. But they both evolved, and they're very similar. They're camera eyes with lenses and retinas and pupils. And in our cases, we get rods and cones. In their cases, they have rods, but they have rods that are capable of detecting color, which our cones are, but our rods aren't. And we've come down to a very similar product due to very similar selection forces.
That's called convergent evolution,
convergent,
right?
Evolution, okay. Correct. But if you look at, you know, other animals, other invertebrates, we actually have examples of pretty much every stage of eye development, from a light-sensitive organelle in a single-celled organism to pits with light-sensitive cells in the bottom of them, like you find in flatworms, to covered pits that have a pupil that contracts but no lens, to covered pits that have a pupil, a lens, and gel, muscular control, all this stuff. We have the whole gamut. It's easy to see that something like the eye could quite easily evolve.
Right.
But then we have something a little bit more difficult to deal with, like the bacterial flagellum, which is a rotary motor, a protein, well, about 43 proteins, as I understand it, that combine to construct this motor. But we don't know what the original purpose of it was. Well, it turns out that there are sort of tendrils that bacteria will use to transfer plasmids of DNA from one to another. I kid you not, they're called sex pilae, which means sex spears. And they sort of shoot back and forth pieces of genetic information one to another, not their entire genome, but plasmids, sort of small rings of DNA.
And they also wrote Anarchy in the UK.
Right. And it's one of the mechanisms by which a bacteria can spread its genetic material to other members of its species without actually procreating. Mm-hmm. It's just something that they do. They share genetic information. But sex pilae are very, very similar, involve almost all of the same proteins. And so now the thinking on the flagellum is that this is a modified sex pilus. And we didn't have that fact at the time that the flagellum was so enigmatic. Now we do. And it's like, oh, okay. Well, now we've seen a little bit more history. We've gotten more details on it. But one of the things that irreducible complexity doesn't really address, at least as a theological argument, is that things don't necessarily always become more complex. Sometimes they become less complex. If you look at bivalve mollusks, clams, mussels, oysters, scallops, that kind of thing, the evolutionary history of them actually shows that they were at one point a much more mobile creature, something more like a sea slug. Something that, you know, traveled around, had eyes, had a sense of smell, hunted its own food. But when they started to develop this shell protection, they didn't need to do any of that, and their more advanced sensory organs became no longer useful, sort of like human tails. They didn't need them anymore. There's no reason to expend energy in developing anymore. And so they just kind of disappeared. And you have this creature that was very active and very complex going to one that is sedentary and simple. This is a thing that happens in evolution. And I think a really good analogy of how a thing like that can occur when you're going from a simple thing to a complex thing, or a complex thing to a simple thing, is I like to explain it looking at evolutionary time as one day. Now, let's say you get to Earth, you're an alien species, you arrive at Earth, and you find a space shuttle in orbit. Well, clearly this thing couldn't have gotten there by itself, and it doesn't have the mechanisms to put itself from the ground into orbit, so it must have been put there by God. Because we didn't know that earlier today it had a giant fuel tank attached to it, it had two booster rockets attached to it, it was sitting on a platform, there was a crane. Well, all this stuff fell away at the moment of launch because it changed its purpose. And what it is now could never have gotten it to where it is now.
Right.
But we didn't see all the machinery that was there before. So going from that sort of more complex to less complex thing, and that's not really an argument that irreducible complexity likes to think about.
Well,
they have this idea that evolution is always getting smarter, stronger, faster, but it's not. It's just getting more successful at propagating, and sometimes being more simple, becoming more simple is the way.
It's a common thing where I think people, we become victims to our metaphors. I think, in a lot of ways. In evolution, this is, in science, I don't think there's anything that has been victimized by its own metaphors as much as evolution has, thanks to that whole thanks to that whole tree of life nonsense, which,
oh boy,
the more we learn about, you know, the more genetics and evolution get together and party, the more we realize how much of a joke that is.
Yes, I'm a bigger fan of the ring model and the web model, because the tree of life kind of indicates or suggests a hierarchy.
I'm a big fan of the orgy model myself, but
the orgy model.
Nobody knows where that. But yeah, it's what we're seeing here with Michael Behe and David Baddori and everybody else is. We're falling victim to our own metaphors, and we're letting the metaphors get in the way of our understanding. Now I can make fun of David Baddori all I like, because, you know, I was not impressed when I had to deal with him. But it's not just atheists who believe in evolution. There's a lot of, when you say, oh, I buy into this irreducible complexity thing, I buy into this. I buy into Michael Behe's argument, you're falling into a very specific camp that maybe your constituents don't necessarily like.
Right.
I think you're making an unverified assumption, and maybe you should talk to some of your science educator constituents, perhaps. Maybe you should, many of whom are going to, in fact, be religious, and not look, you know, and not just count the argument out because one of the guys who's bringing it up is a busload.
Here's the other thing that really gives away David Baddori. His second part of his poem.
Oh, right, it is Baddori.
Yeah, Baddori. Not sure exactly, but
okay.
Here's the thing about King David of Clark County is that here's his giveaway. He does all of this, you know, science talk. He feels very happy involving, you know, terms like flagella and psyllium and all those kinds of things, right? Well, his second part, his part two of his poem, talks about, you know, there's no possible way that this could have gotten here except for our intelligent designer. Oh yeah, so by the way, open the Gospel of John because Jesus wants you to love him.
Right.
So was it an intelligent designer that anyone could buy into, or was it your specific brand of Christianity?
Well, this is
about alienating your constituents.
I love this part of the argument with the irreducible complexity people is that you can literally take a sawzall, find a very specific part in the argument, saw it off, and put any religion in its place, because there's no integration between making a success on the irreducible complexity argument to their specific religion.
Right.
So you can take take a sawzall, you can cut off all the Christianity stuff, and put in
Pikachu,
the modern New Age movement, Star Wars, and a recipe for a quiche. I mean, you could put literally anything in its place. This is where the argument fails, and this is where this ceases to become a science debate and becomes an attempt at injecting religion into a scientific conversation, is they don't make the full argument. They throw a lot of anti-aircraft fire in the air saying, oh, you know, these things don't make any sense, and then immediately say that just because there's anti-aircraft fire in the air, you should shop at Kmart or something. And it's these are arguments that do not connect in any meaningful way.
He's actually quite amazing in hitting the nail on the head in terms of why he tries to connect it to this. Because he says that we're afraid of the evidence the overwhelming amount might mean that we'll answer one day, give account for the things that we did, the life that was given, we might have the answer for the way that we were living, right? So he's saying, literally, this is scary, we are afraid, but take comfort because we should go to the one. There's comfort in knowing a great one has made us, and it gives us reason to live with meaning and purpose. Made us doesn't rhyme with purpose, but, you know, can't have it all. And here's the thing. He's saying, all of this stuff makes me believe in an intelligent designer because I'm ignoring the fact that we're not actually baffled, but we're actually more, we have a better comprehensive knowledge of science and how the world works. So I'm going to ignore that.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to say that this is scary. So now I'm going to say, take comfort. Also, take comfort in the designer. Oh, by the way, the designer is God.
Right.
My God.
So
open the Gospel of John.
Let me get this right. So it's this cute little poem whose point is, we don't understand. Feel terror. Obey God.
Basically.
Okay.
And then obey God because it's really comforting. he asks us to do. Simply love him back and love people too.
No. Yeah, okay, you're making it all nice and wilty and fourth grader reading poetry, but it really is feel terror, obey God.
Yes, it's based on fear.
Yeah, it's a fear argument. That's not a joy argument. There's no fun here. There's no happiness here. This is feel terror, obey God, no matter how nicely worded.
And I think here we have another major difference between scientific thinking and religious thinking. That thing doesn't fit my preconceptions. It's scary. It's scary.
Yeah.
It's not like the way that I think normally. This is scary. This is making me uncomfortable. I don't understand, and I don't want to understand. I just want it to go. And in science, you see, whoa, that was scary. Scary's cool, because scary is new. I don't understand it, but I want to understand it. Let's understand it. I'm going to have to do the scary thing again.
That's the cool way of characterizing it, but I don't think it always works out that way from some people that I've, from a lot of reading that I've done. I don't know. I've made literally zero discoveries.
Wait, wouldn't science actually tell us that when people are experiencing fear, they have cortisol that's released and it interferes with their ability to understand things?
True, yeah.
So perhaps.
Well.
But understood science.
We also have adrenaline released, which, so we have like our short-term adrenaline and our long-term cortisol that...
Things are complex.
I'm going to digress if I go down this one.
Yeah, things are complex. Can we just say that?
Things are
all
complicated.
Right. But not irreducibly. So.
The sink has moved.
But this is somebody who feels safe when he's throwing things out that he doesn't understand so that he can go back to this dogmatic approach that gives him a central position in the universe. And that's the thing that's bringing him peace. Unfortunately, the argument he's making is one of terror. But the reason he's making that terror argument is because on some level, him and people who think like him, it makes them feel safer in order to do this. This argument does not make me feel safe. I have never, and this is where I separate from other religious people, is I do not feel safe under these terms. I have lived with, if not necessarily dogma, my own preconceptions, my own closely held preconceptions about the nature of my life, the nature of my relationships, everything. And I've lived under a false pretense. And I've never felt safe because at some point the rug gets pulled out from under you and bad things happen. And while a lot of people think like, oh my God, that's terrifying, we should do it again, I think sometimes there's sort of a pursuit of competency here where, okay, this thing that we have just discovered, like, let's talk about Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. This thing that we have discovered is terrifying. We need to seek knowledge in order to understand the terrifying thing so that we can face it and defeat it when terrifying happens.
Right.
Sometimes it is in a lot of creepy, there's a lot of parallels in the sort of the religion beating back the darkness thing here. I mean, there are parallels there, but it's not quite the same. It's bringing knowledge to the situation. It's rather than sticking with preconceptions that make you feel comfortable, it's making sure you have the tools to deal with things when they happen.
Sure.
And I think that's incredibly important. I mean, it's...
Absolutely.
It's important to me. I don't... Like I said, I've discovered zero things. but it's definitely a thread I think I've seen in the atheism community. And I think we get that from the scientific community in a lot of ways.
I would agree with that statement. I know very few atheists that don't sort of have an interest in critical thought, scientific consensus, that kind of thing.
Right.
The ones that I've met are quite notable. But
yeah, I've met a few of those guys. But it's strange.
But very few. Yeah.
It does happen.
I imagine we've met the same ones.
Yes. Many of them at this. Yeah, many. We were both in the room when it happened. Yeah.
But I guess the sort of the thing that I find intriguing about it is the scientific perspective on a thing being scary is let's understand how it's scary, let's understand why it's scary, and let's make it not scary.
Yeah.
We've discovered an incredibly destructive force, the power of the atom. Hey, let's see if we can use it to do clean energy, too. Turns out we can. pretty clean. Cleaner than most.
Well, you know, some of these things require a few rounds of operation to figure out, to get all the kinks worked out.
Yeah. I hate to use the term, but of course there are always growing pains in new technology. Just these are particularly nasty growing pains.
I mean, I even use the knowledge to beat back fear things in things that aren't like scientific or universal. Like,
oh no, someone says something horrible on a message board and you say, I must friend that person.
Right.
Or a new unheard of religion or political structure comes up and you just, I've seen you get subsumed for 36 hours learning all that you possibly can about it.
Yeah. It was like when we met up early on, you were...
said, well, man, you don't know much about Judaism.
But I knew a lot about the Klan. But
yes.
I didn't know anything about Judaism because...
You said, Jews aren't scary. They're not trying to interfere with like people I love.
Yeah, they don't scare me. The Klan guys, on the other hand, scared the crap out of me. So I did a lot of reading on them. And then I found out how silly they were. And they ceased being scary.
It was fascinating when I met you how much you knew about specific cults. And I think learning about, you had an acquaintance at one point that was involved with this cult and a family member that got intrigued by this particular one. So you learn tremendous amounts about them in order to not make them scary.
I kind of like to think of the scariness issue. It makes me think of Shark Week on the Discovery Channel. And it was a thing that I was watching years ago. And I remembered this because it just stuck in my memory. And I was actually a little bit hurt by the misunderstanding that happened. And it was just one of those like, wow moments. I'm going to remember this, you know, my whole life. They were doing sort of like a call-in show for people who had questions about like what they were, you know, the documentaries that they were doing and like answering common questions about sharks. I mean, this was probably before facts on the internet. So they were calling in to answer these questions. And this woman called in and she was very angry that they were having shark documentaries at all because those are the devil's creature and one of them ate my brothers or her brother. You know, my brother got eaten by one of them. They're the devil's creatures. They should all be, I don't think she said eradicated, but something to that effect. And the two hosts of the show were just sort of quiet for a few moments and, you know, they were solemn and they said, well, you know, this is a really terrible thing that occurred. You know, we're very sorry that this happened. But then, you know, the next thing that they put on, and of course the programming was planned to be this way, the next thing that they put on was a documentary about why shark attacks happen. And it focused on more people being in the water than have ever been in the water before, offshore food sources being depleted, people not understanding shark behavior. And so you could look at this and go, well, sharks are scary. They're the devil's creatures. They live in the ocean. I'm never going in the ocean again, or I'm just going to fill the whole thing with concrete. Or you could take the scientific turn and go, well, sharks are potentially dangerous. There are some out there. When you're going into the ocean, you're taking a risk. But let's see if we can understand why a shark attack might happen, because that will allow us to avoid it. And then we can sit back and go, sharks are cool. I'm going to watch some sharks and not get attacked by them.
Being on the other side of a video camera, usually, or at least on the other side of a video feed also helps.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
I'll let you guys.
I haven't seen one in person yet when I've been diving, but I'd sure love to.
Okay. It's
something that I kind of hope for every time I dive.
Well, bring a camera.
I do. I always do. Yeah.
I guess we should close this out because this went a bit longer than I thought. But the way I kind of segued from Jesse's email to David Madore, or Madore, whatever, suggests that I'm making an equation between the two. I'm not.
I didn't get that at all, Jesse.
Okay.
I do not view you as David Madore.
I was just thinking about melon-flavored liqueur.
No. Why do you think I made the mistake I did? I think these are all sides of the same discussion, but that doesn't necessarily mean there are only two sides, and I would not characterize it that way. Like I said, this is a conversation that's actually pretty important to me, and part of the reason why I do Ask an Atheist. So taking an extra hour out of my week to do this isn't the problem it looks like. But I think that's going to be all the time we've got for today. Any closing remarks, Dan?
If you fear it, try to understand it.
How about you, Becky?
Psyllium is singular and cilia is plural.
Lemon heads are nice.
Yeah!
Put on sunglasses. Music fades.